Okay, I'll start. I'm going to give these two lectures on quantum interferometry, and I'm going to take the sort of easiest approach possible. So everything I do should be very, very simple mathematically, much simpler than general relativity. But hopefully it'll be sort of interesting and challenging conceptually. I think one of the great things about these interferometers is that they're a very good way to start to look at and get a feel for some of the interesting challenges, the conceptual challenges you get in quantum theory. So I'm going to start with just a problem. And probably most of you went to Yakir Aronoff's seminar about a month ago, I think. So you've unfortunately heard this already. So if you pretend you haven't heard this problem already, or maybe you forgot, which is good. And if you have heard it and you remember it well, then you can just think of this as the sort of thing that you can entertain your non-physicist friends with. So this is the Elitzur-Weidman-Bohm problem. So here's the problem. There's a factory. Okay, there's a factory. And the factory in the factory they make bombs. Here's one of the bombs they make. Has a handle on it, and then sticking out the bottom, it's got a trigger. Okay, so this is the bomb, handle, and this trigger is so incredibly sensitive that if a single particle of any sort whatsoever was to impinge on the trigger, then the bomb will explode. Okay. Now the only problem is that this factory, that the manufacturing process is not 100% perfect. And so sometimes the bombs look like this. The trigger is missing. Okay. So we'll say, and this is perhaps morally dubious, but we'll say this is a good bomb. And that's a bad bomb. Okay. And the challenge is to try and sort these bombs as they come out of the factory such that at the end of the sorting process, you have some bombs that you know are good. Okay. And yet you mustn't have exploded them. Now, it's okay if you explode some bombs in the process, but what we want is that at the end of the day, we'll have some bombs which you know are good, and we haven't exploded them. Okay, maybe we've exploded some bombs in the process, but as long as we have some that we know are good and we haven't exploded, then we will have solved this problem. And it sounds like this is impossible, because the only way to find out if the bomb is a good bomb is to look and see if it has a trigger. The only way to look is to send some at least one particle onto this trigger, and yet if you do that, the bomb will explode. So you'll know that you had a good bomb, but it's no longer possible. Okay, so those of you that went to Yakir's lecture will know the solution to this, but let's persist and pretend you don't. So now I'm going to set up very simple theory for single particle, single mode interferometry. By single mode, I just mean that we're going to treat these particles as if they have a well-defined momentum. This is an approximation that you can relax, and it's quite instructive to do multimode calculations, i.e. calculations where you have some spread in the momentum of the particle. But nevertheless, most of the interesting features you can get just by doing single mode calculations. Incidentally, I understand that the protocol here is that you interrupt whenever you want, and I'm very happy if you interrupt the moment I say something that doesn't make sense. Okay. So I have some, that was one. So I'm just going to go through some of the basic elements of an interferometer. So imagine you have propagation along some length of, so the path, it has a certain length. Then the state, we can write the state just like this. And we can say the state goes to so as we propagate along some path length, the state just gets multiplied by a factor by this complex number. And k is equal to 2 pi over the wavelength associated with the particle. It's the wave number. And so what's happening is that as if the length is equal to an integer number of wavelengths, then this is equal to 1. Okay. And just for simplicity, I'm going to imagine all the path lengths which are relevant are such that L is equal to an integer number of wavelengths. So I'm just going to take that this is always equal to 1. You can get, we'll get the phase in a different way using something called a phase shifter, which is this. So here's a phase shifter. So now, the phase shifter does that. Okay. And a phase shifter will typically be you can implement a phase shift in different ways. So one way would just to be to have some small change, make some small changes in the length of the path so that you vary the phase. You can see if you change the path by delta L, then you'll change the phase as you do that. Another way to do a phase shift is to send the particle through some material that slows it down a bit. So if the particle were a photon, then you could send it through a piece of glass, and that will slow the particle down a little bit and cause it to have a phase shift relative to what it would have had had it not gone through the glass. Okay. The next thing is a mirror. So often we'll have something like this. And so a mirror, we just treat that. That's just the same sort of thing. What notation do I use? E to the I. The particle is going to accumulate some phase shift when it bounces off a mirror. Now, again, we might as well just ignore this because we can just regard it as being part of the phase shift that's accumulated due to the length of propagation. And we can set it so that the overall phase shift that's due to anything other than a phase shifter is just equal, it's just equivalent to L being an integer number of wavelengths. So we're just going to treat it so that e to the I alpha equals 1. Okay. And that will be perfectly okay. Yep. Oh, you mean the direction of propagation?
I mean, for example, from the neutrinos, it's the parity wouldn't change.
By the parity, you mean the
p?
P.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it will change the direction. Sure. But it does, for the calculations I'm going to show you, you can just do what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. You could put all that stuff in. It would just make the calculation more complicated, and you'd get the same answer. So people normally ignore the mirrors. Sometimes people don't even put mirrors in. They just sort of they draw something like this, you know. And imagine that the path curves. But I'm going to put mirrors in just so we have straight lines. But it is true that there would actually be an effect due to the mirror. It's just we can ignore it, and it doesn't make any difference to these calculations. Okay.
Could you please explain again why we could set e to the I alpha to 1?
So we could set it not equal to 1. And then we could then just, in the calculation, we'll see in any particle that's propagating along will travel along some path length. Maybe it hits a mirror. We'll choose the path length such that e to the I kl plus alpha due to any mirrors is equal to 1. OK. So we can basically just vary the path length slightly so that alpha is absorbed into just assuming that this is equal to 1. And then any variation in phase, we're going to put that in the phase shifter so that we can just consider varying the phase shifter to get all the physical shifting phase. Maybe when I do the calculation for the interferometer, you can see how that works. And if you're still unhappy, we can talk about it. Okay. I'm just trying to make our lives easy. Okay. So the next object is the beam splitter. So in the case, for example, of a photon, a beam splitter would be a half-silvered or a partially silvered a mirror. In the case of, for example, maybe an electron beam, you could implement a beam splitter by having the electron beam impinge on a wire that has some charge. So that will cause the beam to split into two pieces. So depending on what kind of particle you have, you can implement a beam splitter in different ways. But the idea is that we have a path coming here, a path coming here, and we mix them in some way, the beam splitter, and then they come out at the other side. Let's treat, first of all, the 50-50 beam splitter. This is number 5. Okay. So in the case of a 50-50 beam splitter, we can treat it like this. Any idea why I've chosen those particular coefficients?
Is it something to do with the polarization of the photons? Because if you've got these nice coefficients, then the photon will be circularly polarized?
No, because here I'm just imagining I'm not treating any internal degrees of the freedom of the particle. So if these were photons, I'd just be imagining that they all have the same polarization. I'm not using that degree of freedom. I'm just treating the sort of the spatial degree of freedom. So it's not for that reason. Anyone else? Yeah.
So like the probability, and is the total probability out?
Okay, so that certainly would have to be the case. So definitely that explains the 1 over root 2. So you know, the probability here is 1, and then you have 1 over root 2 squared plus 1 over root 2 squared is equal to 1. So that explains that, but it doesn't explain the phase.
Well, I guess in the case of reflection, we have a change in phase. And so the I is for that.
Yeah, so that's a sort of more physical answer, but there's a more general sort of answer for this. Any more?
The result of A and the result of B are also
enough. Good, yes. So initially, these are two things we can distinguish, whether the particle is in this path or this path. are things we can distinguish. So in particular, we have to have A, B is orthogonal. And furthermore, so as we evolve these things, this is a reversible unitary evolution. So unitary evolution has the property that it preserves the overlap. So after the beam splitter, it has to be the case that this is true also. So if you do a calculation, you'll see that this and this, that you'll see that the product of these two things is equal to zero. Let's just do that calculation since it's instructive. So I'm taking the dual of this. Now we have C here there's a minus 1 I times I, that's plus. What have I missed out?
Didn't you have I in front of CC?
Yeah, sorry, it should be an I there. So just as the each of these is normalized, so this has to be equal to 1, and this has to be equal to 1, and these things have to be equal to 0 because they're two distinct paths, so their overlap is 0. So we get 0, which is what we require. So these things initially, if they're orthogonal, they remain orthogonal. Yeah. Oh, you have to.
Is there a reason why we chose I and not plus and minus?
Good. So no, the only reason, with a beam splitter, you can choose any set of coefficients that make this transformation unitary.
Yeah.
Some people prefer to put plus here, minus here, and plus here, and that also will do it. The good thing about using I is that then every time when you're doing a calculation, every time you see reflection from a beam splitter, you just put an I in. Mm. Whereas if you have a if you have a plus here and a minus here, then it depends on which direction things are going.
Okay.
So you have to be a bit more careful. Now, physically, it does actually make a difference which one you have. But once again, you can absorb any such phase into the path length and not really care about it. And you'd have to do a very refined kind of measurement to actually determine what the exact transformation matrix was for this beam splitter. And in any case, it doesn't matter. Unless you're making extremely accurate measurements of the path length itself, you might as well just assume that the path length, that any such effects are incorporated into the path length, so it makes no difference. Okay. It's interesting, in the early days, every now and then someone would do a beam splitter calculation, but they would get the wrong, they would write down a transformation that wasn't unitary, just make a mistake. And then you can do all sorts of crazy things, like basically when you have non-unitary evolution, in this context, all hell breaks loose. And you have people thinking that they discovered faster than light signaling. For example, that's one of the things that will happen if you start to use non-unitary transformations in this context. Okay. This is for a 50-50 beam splitter. If you have a if you have a beam splitter which has some reflectivity and transmittivity. So you could say you could talk about one that has transmissivity T and R as the reflectivity. Then the transformation is just like this. I'll draw it in matrix form. And that's also a unitary transformation. So now we can think about some experiments. So I'm going to just do the most basic experiment we can think about. So the most basic experiment you could imagine is something like an anti-correlation experiment. So you have a particle coming from some source, and you have detectors. So here you'd say, well, imagine this is some beam splitter that has transmissivity T and reflectivity R. Then we'd have the initial state goes to the final state. And we can ask, what's the probability, if we place these detectors here, of seeing the particle in path C? And the probability of C, so that's just T. So, and then the probability of seeing it in path path T is that. Okay. So obviously very straightforward. Although even here already you've hit probably the deepest problem in quantum theory. This is a very simple calculation, but if you look at this, it contains a superposition of different terms. If I was to do this calculation a bit more carefully, I would actually have a state for the detectors in place as well. So let me just do that. I won't do this normally. Let me just do it this time. So we have a detector primed and ready to go in state 0 in path C, another detector primed and ready to go in path D. And now you can see what's going to happen. We'll either have that this particle hits detector C and causes that one to go into an excited state, leaving this one in an unexcited state. Or the other way around. So this star indicates that the detector has fired. So now if you look at this, what we have is a superposition of two different macroscopic situations. Either this detector has fired or this one has. And yet we have a superposition of those two different things. And so that's basically the measurement problem. It's sort of like Schrodinger's cat. If we do the calculation, we get a superposition. But when you actually look, you only see one of these two things. Okay, so this is one of the basic problems with quantum theory. I won't talk about it anymore because people have written books and we don't have time. But already, just this very simple experiment, we hit immediately one of the deep conceptual problems in quantum theory. Okay. So now let's do a calculation for an interferometer. Okay. I'm going to use notation for this interferometer that slightly odd. It's this is the notation that they used in the original Elitzer-Weidman paper. This is called a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. There's another configuration that you may see. That's the Michelson-Morley interferometer. Famous because of the experiment to test and see if the Earth's frame had any, the drag of the Earth's frame had any effect on the speed of light. But we'll stick with this one, which is just a bit simpler conceptually. Okay, and then I'm going to assume that these beam splitters are 50-50. And let's imagine that we have a particle coming in path A. Okay. So in comes the particle. So it hits this beam splitter. Some gets reflected, some gets transmitted. It's a 50-50 beam splitter, so we have 1 over root 2. I in front of the part that gets reflected. And just a 1 in front of the part that gets transmitted. Okay. Next, we can now take this path here. Particle goes through a phase shift. Like that. And now next, we can separately take each of these terms through the second beam splitter. We're going to get another 1 over root 2 factor. So that's just going to become a 1 over half outside everything. Okay, and then so U will go, well, the bit that's transmitted into C just goes through as it is. And then the bit that's reflected into D will pick up an I, so that becomes minus 1. So that's the U part. And now the B part, V is transmitted into C, so we get an I, C, and then it's reflected into C, and it's transmitted into D. And that's that, okay? So we just simplify that. It's equal to, We have 1 over 2. We collect together the C terms. We have an I in front of each of them. Then E to the I phi plus 1. Now collect together the D terms. We have minus e to the I phi. Okay. So we can do a calculation. The probability of seeing a C is equal to the square modulus of this coefficient. Oh, I shouldn't forget the half turns into a quarter. And if you do your maths, if I do my maths, I get this.
Sorry, I don't understand how did you get this expression, the first line, the last term.
Which one, sorry?
The first line, the last term.
Yep, first line, last term, okay. So what I did was U is going to be expanded into, well, if you look at this, U's coming along here. So it goes to 1 over root 2, and then it's transmitted into C, and it's reflected into D. So I have, so just using that beam, the same beam splitter equations I had from before, just applying it to this beam splitter, I get that. And a similar thing for V, do the calculation again. And so I've just substituted in place of U that, in place of V, a similar thing. Is that clear?
Yeah.
And then collect together terms. Yeah. It's simpler than you think. These calculations are incredibly simple, yet you get a lot of interesting physics out. Any more questions? Okay. Right, so the probability of getting a C, is this corner of the blackboard difficult to see? Okay. Can you even see that? Okay. And then the probability of a D is, go over here. See this kind of is 1 over 4, this coefficient squared, then you do the trigonometry, you get 1 over 2, one minus cos 5. So so the curves, just obviously what you're getting is, in the case of C, if you plot here, let's find more space over here. I think I'll just erase this and start. So for C, you just get this. This is probably for C. And for D, you get one that's just the opposite, sort of. Like so. Okay. And these two things have to add to one because something has to happen. How long does this lecture go on? Is it now in 75
minutes?
Yes,
okay.
So we started at
1:30.
Yeah. So quarter to 3. Okay, good.
We have a little bit of leeway.
Right. Okay, but I'll try and stick to that. Okay. So just the first exercise, since you have a tutorial tomorrow. Is to do the same calculation, but where we have variable, where we have some beam splitters that have, rather than being 50-50, have transdiffusivity and reflectivity equal to T and R. Might as well take it to be the same, both beam splitters. And to calculate probability of D, of C and D. And then also calculate the visibility. That's equal to the probability, the maximum probability C minus the minimum probability of C divided by the sum. Of the maximum and the minimum.
Can I have one question? Is there any way to see intuitively if that if there is no phase at all, there is only one, there is only the C1 the C1 surviving, and is there any way to see it intuitively?
So you see it immediately. Yeah, because you can already see it just here with the fact that we have this point here.
Yeah.
But if you do the calculation and you set phi equal to 0 and you just look through this, that means that everywhere you have an e to the I phi factor, it's just set equal to 1. And so when you look at this, this thing is equal to 2, and yet this thing is equal to 0. And so you see that this one dies.
Physically?
Oh, why physically?
Yeah.
I understand. I don't have a good answer to that question. I mean, there probably is a good answer in terms of momentum conservation, but I can't give it to you. I don't know the best way to say that. Any tutors have an answer to that?
What's P minimum and maximum?
Sorry, what's
minimum and maximum?
Yeah. So when I plotted this graph, in the case of the 50-50 beam splitters, the maximum is 1, and the minimum is 0.
So in this graph, we have like a phase shift.
So in this case, in this graph, so the point is, you take the maximum and the minimum as you vary phase. So you should do, sorry, I should have put a phase in here. So as you vary phase, you take the maximum and the minimum. And rather than getting a curve that goes up and down from 0 and 1, it's going to go somewhere in between. And usually the way people in interferometry measure the sort of lack of perfection is by the visibility measure. I'll think about.
Yeah, for the phase equals 0, I think that's if you just have two waves, they interfere.
Yeah.
Each BIM splitter introduces an I phase shift to the waves.
Yeah.
So those two add and give interference on one side, destructive, constructive on the other side.
Yeah.
So that's just in the wave picture.
Yeah. So I think that's right.
Does it depend on our definition of a unitary transformation at a beam splitter? For example, if we define the unitary transformation in a beam splitter to be that A goes to C plus D and B goes to C minus D,
then you would get a different answer. But I feel like there's a better answer to that, and I don't know the question. Whose question was it? I feel like there's a better answer to that question, but I don't know. So just going back to those remarks I made at the beginning where I said I'm just going to regard this thing equal to 1 and that thing equal to 1, if I hadn't done that, then you'd just have some slight phase added to this phi through here. And in the end, what would happen is your curves will be shifted along slightly. All the qualitative details will be the same, but just be a slight shift. I'm trying to make our lives simple, so I didn't treat that. So the solution to the Elitzer-Weidman bomb problem, which I'm sure since everybody went to Yakir Aharonov's talk, knows already. And I'll give it again. I haven't been very intelligent in using these blackboards. I'll bring this down. So we're going to take this max enter interferometer and set phi equal to 0. What that means is, as we discussed, that this C detector will always fire, and this D detector will never fire. Incidentally, that was the reason that Elitzer and Weidman used D here, because this is dark. Okay, so this is the dark output. But that's only true if we have interference. If we place some obstacle here, and in particular, if that obstacle is the trigger of a hypersensitive bomb, like so. So if the trigger is actually present, then there'll no longer be interference. And in that case, you can do the calculation. What's going to happen is, well, let's go through the calculation. We have A goes in. Here we have B and U. A goes to 1 over root 2 of I U plus V. The next thing that happens is, if this impinges on the bomb, we just get an explosion. With an I in front. Okay. One of the great things about the bra cat notation is that you can write stuff inside the bras. And then the next thing that will happen is this term here will pass through this interferometer. So let's just do that. It's V is reflected into C, and it's transmitted into D. Oh, and there's another 1 over root 2. Okay. And now we do a measurement. So we either get, and we look at this, we get one of three things. Either we get an explosion, or we see this outcome, or we see the D outcome, okay? If we get an explosion, then we know that we had a good bomb, but it's exploded, so that information is sort of redundant. Not a bit painful. If we get C, then we don't know. C would have happened anyway. If this trigger was missing, we would have got C. So that doesn't tell us anything about the bomb. Actually, it's probably not strictly speaking true to say we learn nothing. We slightly change the probabilities one way or another. We definitely learn nothing conclusive. The bomb could still be good or bad if we get C. On the other hand, if we get a D, well, we know we could not have got the D outcome if the trigger was not present, because then we would have had constructive interference. This detector would have fired. This one could not fire. So in this case, we know you have a good bomb. And yet, the bomb hasn't exploded. Okay. Just put the trigger back in. So this is kind of remarkable from a classical point of view. We're able to deduce the presence of an object, namely the trigger, without sort of interacting with it. You know, the genius of Elitzer and Weibmann was to think of a really dramatic way of putting that. It was interesting, this paper, so I was very fortunate when this paper came out because they sent a copy to my supervisor. This was in the days before the archive. So back in those days, people used to send copies of their papers to, you know, people they thought might be interested in. And so they sent a copy to my supervisor. In the meantime, they tried to publish it. They failed to get it published in Physical Review Letters. The referees thought it was just too obvious. They failed to get it published in another journal, Physics Letters A, I think. And then finally, they got it published in Foundations of Physics, which, you know, could publish almost anything. And yet, in the meantime, I think this has become regarded as sort of one of the sort of most beautiful illustrations of the beauty of quantum theory. You know, Yakir Haranov talks about it. Roger Penrose talks about it in his book. Many people present it as one of the first problems in quantum theory. And it's very strange. How is it possible that you can detect the presence of something without, you know, in some sense without interacting with it? So sometimes people call this interaction-free measurement. Although, you know, you could argue that it isn't completely interaction-free measurement because there is a wave function impinging on it. Any questions about that?
But 2/3 of the bombs will be exploded, right?
Right, yeah, good. Yeah. So that brings me to exercise 2.
You don't know how many bad bombs there are in
Canada. Not just all the good bombs.
Yeah, all the good ones. So not all the bombs.
This is exercise 2. Optimize. So imagine that you happen to have a sort of batch of bombs and they're all good, but you don't know that. Can you optimize the ratio of bombs that are successfully tested without being exploded? Sorry, my handwriting is beautiful. Over. So we're optimizing the ratio of the bombs successfully tested without being exploded. So the number of bombs tested. Okay, and this is this problem has an interesting answer. Sorry. Anything you want, just you have to test, you have to optimize anything that will optimize the ratio.
So do we have a limit on visibility?
That will be telling you how to solve the problem. Yeah.
Do we restrict like the minimum visibility that we can detect?
I mean, you could certainly think about varying that. Yeah. I should perhaps warn you, this is not an entirely fair problem. I'm giving you it's more interesting than you might imagine.
What did you write on the first line?
I can't read my own handwriting now. The number of bombs successfully tested without being exploded.
Wow.
So I can tell you that from memory. So just the obvious thing that you would want to optimize. Okay.
And how much is this ratio?
Sorry, what's the answer?
Yes. Not the answer. What's the number?
Sorry.
What's the number?
Oh.
The final number. It would be a guide.
All right, yeah, yeah. It's somewhere between 0 and 1. Okay.
Maybe a question. I mean, in this calculation that you did, you don't know if the bomb has a trigger or not. So there is a really...
Oh, yeah, but let's imagine, although you don't know it, you happen to have a batch of bombs that all have a trigger. And so you're just optimizing.
Obviously, the answer depends on whether you know how many.
So you're optimizing, given that it so happens that the bombs have a trigger. Yeah, because of course, if none of the bombs have a trigger, okay. Right. So I'm going to move on to two particles in a moment. But let me just first of all see if I can get a bit more out of this single particle interferometer. Where can I go? Okay, so just one more thing that's worth talking about before we move on to two particles. So one question is it possible to understand an interferometer and to understand what happens in interferometers with a sort of simple particle picture in mind? Okay, well, we all know the answer is no, but let me just go through that argument. So here's the idea. Imagine that we're trying to explain what happens here in such a way that there's just a particle that bounces off this beam splitter. And it either goes one way or the other. So either that happens or that happens. Okay. And in the case where it goes this way, nothing goes the other way. And in the case where it goes this way, nothing goes the other way. So this is a particle picture. Can we explain what happens in the interferometer with this particle picture? So I'm just going to go through the argument that we can't. If we have no phase shifter in here, we send a particle in here, we know it definitely has to come out here. So this detector will fire. On the other hand, if we place a phase shifter in here, which is just equal to pi, then the opposite thing happens. This detector fires. Okay. So let's just try to explain that in terms of this naive particle picture. So imagine we have the case the particle comes in. It can go this way or this way. Let's imagine it goes this way. Okay, it goes along here. It comes to here. And now it doesn't know whether it's in the situation that these two path lengths are equal. So there's no phase shift in here. Or they're different because it doesn't experience anything along this path. And so there's no way for this particle to know whether it's supposed to go in this direction or this direction. So the particle, the naive particle picture fails. Any questions? This is an argument you would have seen many times for the double slit interferometer, and then making it in the context of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. If you want to know how it's possible to have a picture in which there nevertheless are particles, then you should ask Hans, since he works on that. But there is an interpretation of the pilot wave model in which you have both a particle and a wave. And in that case, it is possible to explain what happens here. Okay. Okay, so two particles. And I'm still going to use the single mode approximation. So we have two particles. A1. B2. So the integer tells you which particle it is. The letter tells you which path. So the notation to use for the state in this case is A1 tensor product A2. I'm using slightly abbreviated notation. Sometimes people write that. But in the kind of calculations we're doing, this just makes the notation a bit more messy, so we can just omit it. In the case, so when you have this, we imagine there's a tensor product between the two. Okay. And now you can do all the same kinds of calculations, but now you have to just deal with having two particles knocking around. So for example, if each of these particles passes through a phase shift, then the state will evolve to e to the I by 1, e to the I by 2. Like that. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so now let's start to look at some, what I'm going to do here is describe a sort of overlapping interferometers experiment that I came up with about 10 years ago now. And if you went to Yakir Aharonov's talk, you would have heard him talk about this very briefly at the end. But I'm going to go through it in detail. So first of all, let's just erase this and start again. Imagine we have a positron and an electron. Okay. We let each of them go through a beam splitter. So I'll call the input path for the positron A plus, and then the two output paths U plus and V plus. And I'll call the input path for the electron A minus, and the two output paths U minus and V minus. Sorry. Okay. So here we have two particles. One is an electron, one is a positron. They each hit a beam splitter, and then the reflected paths come to meet here. Now we're going to imagine, this is just a sort of Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment. We're going to imagine that if the electron and the positron meet in this place, then they annihilate with probability equal to 1. It's probably not a realistic assumption for a positron and an electron, but you can certainly think of physical systems where this would happen. Okay. Now let's place detectors in all the paths. And so one thing you can say about this situation is that it will never happen that this detector and this detector fire. Because the only way that could happen is if the two particles pass through here, and in so doing they would have annihilated. Okay, to do the calculation for that, let's just do that. The initial state is that we have two particles going into the interferometers. Now we have each particle passes a beam splitter. Now I can just multiply this out. So I get minus We have four terms. And then, as these two particles pass through this interaction region, this term is taken out. It turns into gamma rays. And then all these terms are still the same. Okay. And so you can see that the probability of getting u plus and u minus is equal to zero because there is no u plus and u minus term in this expression. And so this statement is true. Any questions there?
Can you repeat the last part?
Which is the last bit?
The last sentence.
The last sentence, okay. Maybe I should not be lazy and just write this whole thing down. Okay. Okay. So if you look at this expression, it has an amplitude for everything. U plus and V minus for V plus and U minus for V plus and V minus, but it doesn't have an amplitude for U plus and U minus because it's turned into gamma rays. So the probability of getting U plus and U minus has to be zero. In other words, it never happens that these two detectors fire. Okay. So that's the first statement. Yeah, you know, looking at the time, it's obviously not going to be possible for me to tell you everything about this example in the remaining minute. So what I'll do is I'm going to stop there. I could give you one more exercise. Would that be useful? Do you think there's three or enough? One more. Okay. Or oh, you're right. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, of course. Sorry. Yeah. Okay, just two. I'll give one more exercise. Okay. So I'm going to continue presenting this example tomorrow. So, but just because I think I need to give you one more exercise, this is a sort of similar kind of problem, but different. So here's the exercise. Exercise three. Imagine we have a source that emits it's a two-particle source. I'll explain this in a moment. Well, no, I'll explain this now. So the idea is that particle one comes out in this direction, and either it goes along path BA or path B. Particle two comes out in this direction, either it goes along path A or path B. And now the state is taken to be this state. One over root two, a1, a2, plus b1, b2. Can anyone describe just physically, intuition as to what that state is?
Conservation of momentum?
Yeah, you could say it like that. Yeah, so decay, yeah. So, one way to produce this would be to have two particles which are initially in a sort of zero, have zero momenta. Well, have a bound particle that decays into two pieces. Then you could collect in these two directions. There are interesting ways of producing this kind of situation using photons as well, as I may talk about tomorrow. Okay, so that's the initial state. And now imagine that these two paths are brought together. onto a beam splitter. Like so, with a phase shifter in place. And this path is now C1. This path is D1 on the one side. Then we can do the same thing on the other side. Phase shifter here. Okay. And the exercise is to calculate the probability, which is going to be a function of theta 1 and theta and phi 1 and phi 2, of getting C1, C2, and also, since you're doing it, you might as well calculate if you feel like it. C1, D2, D1, C2, and D1, D2. So this is an interesting calculation. It's sort of a two-particle analog of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer we saw earlier. And it has interesting properties. Okay, so what I'll do is tomorrow I'll continue discussing this example here. And then I'm going to look at some photon type experiments where you need a little bit more background. So there's some interesting quantum optical experiments that were done. And I think they show you some very nice features of quantum theory. So I'll do that tomorrow. Thanks.